Chapter 20. Now that Hank had $250 of Samson's money in his pocket, he was even less enthusiastic about picking cotton.
"Where's Hank?"
Pappy asked Mr. Sproul as we took the sacks and began our work on Monday morning.
"Sleeping, I reckon,"
was the abrupt response, and nothing else was said at that moment. He arrived in the field sometime in the middle of the morning. I didn't know exactly when, because I was at the far end of a row of cotton, but soon I heard voices and knew that the Spruels were once again at war. An hour or so before lunch, the sky began to darken and a slight breeze came from the west. When the sun disappeared, I stopped picking and studied the clouds. 100 yards away, I saw Pappy do the same thing, hands on hips, straw hat cocked to one side, face frowning upward. The wind grew stronger and the sky darker, and before long the heat was gone. All of our storms came from Jonesboro, which was known as Tornado Alley. Hail hit first, hard, tiny specks the size of pea gravel, and I headed for the tractor. The sky to the southwest was dark blue, almost black, and the low clouds were bearing down on us. The Spruels were moving quickly down their rows, all headed for the trailer. The Mexicans were running toward the barn. I began to run too. The hail stung the back of my neck and prompted me to run even faster. The wind was howling through the trees along the river and pushing the cotton stalks to their sides. Lightning cracked somewhere behind me, and I heard one of the Spruels, Bo probably, give a yell.
"We don't need to get near the cotton trailer,"
Pappy was saying as I arrived.
"Not with that lightning."
"Better get to the house,"
my father said. We loaded onto the flatbed trailer, all of us scrambling in a great hurry, and just as Pappy turned the tractor around, the rain hit with a fury. It was cold and sharp and falling sideways in the fierce wind. We were instantly soaked. I wouldn't have been wetter if I'd jumped in the creek. The Spruels huddled together with Tally in the center. Just a few feet away, my father clutched me to his chest as if the wind might take me away. My mother and Gran had left the fields not long before the storm hit. The rain beat us in waves. It was so thick, I could barely see the rows of cotton just a few feet in front of me.
"Hurry up, Pappy,"
I kept saying. The storm was so loud, I couldn't hear the familiar knock of the tractor engine. Lightning cracked again, this time much closer, so close that my ears hurt. I thought we were going to die. It took forever to get to the house, but when we did, the rain suddenly stopped. The sky was even darker, black in every direction.
"It's a funnel,"
Mr. Spruill said loudly as we were just getting off the trailer. To the west, far beyond the river and high above the tree line, a slim funnel cloud dipped downward. It was light gray, almost white against the black sky, and it grew larger and louder as it made its way very slowly toward the ground. It was several miles away, and because of the distance, it didn't seem too dangerous. Tornadoes were common in our part of Arkansas, and I'd heard stories about them all my life. Decades earlier, Gran's father had supposedly survived a horrible twister, one that had run in circles and struck the same small farm more than once. It was a tall tale, one that Gran told without much conviction. Twisters were a way of life, but I'd not seen one until now.
"Kathleen!"
my father yelled toward the house. He didn't want my mother to miss such a spectacle. I glanced at the barn, where the Mexicans were as still and as amazed as we were. A couple of them were pointing. We watched the funnel in muted fascination, without fear or terror, because it was nowhere near our farm and going away to the north and east. It moved slowly, as if it were searching for the perfect place to touch down. Its tail was clearly visible above the horizon, way above the land, and it skipped along in midair, dancing at times while it decided where and when to strike. The bulk of the funnel spun tightly, a perfect upside-down cone, whirling in a fierce spiral. The screen door slammed behind us. My mother and Gran were on the steps, both of them wiping their hands on their dish towels.
"It's headed for town,"
Pappy said, with great authority, as if he could predict where tornadoes would hit.
"I think so,"
my father added, suddenly another expert weatherman. The twister's tail sank lower and stopped skipping. It appeared as if it had indeed touched down somewhere far away, because we could no longer see the end of it. The church, the gin, the movie theater, Pop and Pearl's grocery, I was tallying the damage when suddenly the twister lifted itself up and seemed to disappear completely. There was another roar behind us, across the road, deep into the Jeter property. Another tornado had arrived. It had crept up on us while we were watching the first one. It was a mile or two away and seemed headed straight for our house. We watched in horror, unable to move for a second or two.
"Let's get in the barn," Pappy shouted.
Some of the Spruels were already running toward their camp, as if they'd be safe inside a tent.
"Over here,"
Mr. Spruel shouted and pointed to the barn. Suddenly everyone was yelling and pointing and scurrying about. My father grabbed my hand and we began running. The ground was shaking and the wind was screaming. The Mexicans were scattering in all directions. Some thought it best to hide in the fields. Others were headed toward our house until they saw us running to the barn. Hank flew past me with Trot on his back. Tally outran us, too. Before we made it to the barn, the twister left the ground and rose quickly into the sky. Pappy stopped and watched, and so did everybody else. The funnel went slightly to the east of our farm, and instead of a frontal assault, it left behind only a sprinkling of thick brown rainwater and specks of mud. We watched it jump along in midair, looking for another site to drop down in, just like the first one. For a few minutes, we were too stunned and too frightened to say much. I studied the clouds in all directions, determined not to be blindsided again. I wasn't the only one cutting my eyes around. Then it started raining once more, and we went to the house. The storm raged for 2 hours and threw almost everything in nature's arsenal at us. Gale force winds and blinding rains, twisters, hail, and lightning so quick and so close that we hid under our beds at times. The Spruels took refuge in our living room, while we cowered throughout the rest of the house. My mother kept me close. She was deathly afraid of storms, and that made the entire ordeal even worse. I wasn't exactly sure how we would die, blown away by the wind, or seared by a lightning bolt, or swept away by the water, but it was obvious to me that the end had come. My father slept through most of it, though, and his indifference was a great comfort. He'd lived in foxholes and had been shot at by Germans, so nothing frightened him. The three of us lay on the floor of the bedroom, my father snoring, my mother praying, and me in the middle, listening to the sounds of the storm. I thought of Noah and his 40 days of rain, and I waited for our little house to simply lift up and begin floating. When the rain and wind finally passed, we went outside to survey the destruction. Other than wet cotton, there was surprisingly little damage. Several scattered tree branches, the usual washed-out gullies, and some ripped-up tomato plants in the garden. The cotton would be dry by the next morning, and we'd be back in business. During a late lunch, Pappy said, "I reckon I better go check on a gin." We were anxious to get to town. What if it had been leveled by the twister?
"I'd like to see the church," Grant said.
"Me too," I said.
"Why do you want to see the church?"
my father asked.
"To see if the twister got it."
"Let's go,"
Pappy said, and we jumped from our chairs. The dishes were piled into the sink and left unwashed, something I'd never seen before. Our road was nothing but mud, and in places large sections had been washed away. We slipped and slid for a quarter of a mile till we came to a crater. Pappy rammed it in low and tried to plow through the ditch on the left side next to the Jeter's cotton. The truck stopped and settled, and we were hopelessly stuck. My father hiked back to the house to get the John Deere while we waited. As usual, I was in the back of the truck, and so I had plenty of room to move around. My mother was packed in front with Pappy and Gran. I think it was Gran who said something to the effect that perhaps it wasn't such a good idea to go to town after all. Pappy just stewed. When my father returned, he hooked a 20-foot log chain to the front bumper and slowly pulled us out of the ditch. The men had decided it was best for the tractor to drag us all the way to the bridge. When we got there, Pappy unhitched the chain, and my father rode over on the tractor. Then we crossed in the truck. The road on the other side was even worse, according to the men.
So they rehitched the chain, and the tractor pulled the truck for 2 miles until we came to a gravel road. We left the John Deere there and headed for town, if in fact it was still there. God only knew what carnage awaited us. I could barely conceal my excitement. We finally made it to the highway, and when we turned toward Black Oak, we left a long trail of mud on the asphalt. Why couldn't all roads be paved? I asked myself. Things appeared normal as we drove along. No flattened trees or crops, no debris slung for miles, no gaping holes through the landscape. All the houses seemed to be in order. The fields were empty because the cotton was wet. But other than that, life had not been disturbed. Standing in the back of the truck, looking over the cab with my father, I strained my eyes for the first glimpse of town. It arrived soon enough. The gin was roaring as usual. God had protected the church. The stores along Main Street were intact.
Thank God, my father said.
I was not unhappy to see the buildings untouched, but things could have been more interesting. We weren't the only curious ones. Traffic was heavy on Main Street, and people crowded the sidewalks. This was unheard of for a Monday. We parked at the church, and once we determined that it had not been hit, I scampered down to Pop and Pearl's, where the foot traffic appeared to be particularly thick. Mr. Red Fletcher had a group going, and I got there just in time. According to Mr. Red, who lived west of town, he had known a twister was about to appear, because his old beagle was hiding under the kitchen table, a most ominous sign. Taking his cue from his dog, Mr. Red began studying the sky, and before long was not surprised to see it turn black. He heard the twister before he saw it. It dipped down from nowhere, came straight for his farm, and stayed on the ground long enough to flatten 2 chicken coops and peel the roof off his house. A piece of glass struck his wife and drew blood, so that we had a bona fide casualty. Behind me, I heard folks whisper excitedly about driving out to the Fletcher place to inspect the destruction.
What'd it look like?
Somebody asked.
Black as coal, Mr. Red said. Sounded like a freight train.
This was even more exciting because our twisters had been a light gray in color, almost white. His had been black. Apparently, all manner of tornadoes had ravaged our county. Mrs. Fletcher appeared at his side, her arm heavily bandaged and in a sling, and we couldn't help but stare. She looked as though she might just pass out on the sidewalk. She displayed her wound and received plenty of attention until Mr. Red realized he'd lost the audience, so he stepped forward and resumed his narrative. He said his tornado left the ground and began hopping about. He jumped in his truck and tried to follow it. He gave it a good chase through a driving hailstorm and almost caught up with it as it circled back. Mr. Red's truck was older than Pappy's. Some of those in the crowd began looking around in disbelief. I wanted one of the adults to ask,
"What were you going to do if you caught it, Red?"
Anyway, he said he soon gave up the chase and returned home to see about Mrs. Fletcher. When he had seen it last, his tornado was headed straight for town. Pappy told me later that Mr. Red Fletcher would tell a lie when the truth sounded better. There was a lot of lying that afternoon in Black Oak, or perhaps just a lot of exaggerating. Twister stories were told and retold from one end of Main Street to the other. In front of the co-op, Pappy described what we'd seen, and for the most part, he stuck to the facts. The double twister story carried the moment and had everyone's attention until Mr. Dutch Lamb stepped forward and claimed to have seen 3. His wife verified it, and Pappy went to the truck. By the time we left town, it was a miracle that hundreds hadn't been killed. The last of the clouds were gone by dark, but the heat did not return. We sat on the porch after supper and waited for the cardinals. The air was clear and light, the first hint of autumn. 6 games were left, 3 against the Reds and 3 against the Cubs, all to be played at home at Sportsman's Park. But with the Dodgers 7 games in first place, the season was over. Stan, the man usual, was leading the league in batting and slugging, and he also had more hits and doubles than anyone else. The Cardinals would not win the pennant,
but we still had the greatest player in the game. At home, after a road trip to Chicago, the boys were happy to be back in St. Louis, according to Harry Carey, who often passed along greetings and gossip, as if all the players lived in his house. Musial hit a single and a triple, and the score was tied at 3 after 9 innings. It was late, but we weren't tired. The storm had chased us from the fields, and the cool weather was something to be savored. The Sproles were sitting around a fire, talking softly and enjoying a moment without Hank. He often disappeared after supper. In the bottom of the 10th, Red Shandeen singled, and when Stan Musial came to the plate, the fans went wild, according to Harry Carey, who, as Pappy said, often watched one game and described another. The attendance was fewer than 10,000. We could tell the crowd was slim, but Harry was making enough noise for the other 20,000. After 148 games, he was just as excited as he'd been on opening day. Musial ripped a double, his third hit of the game, scoring Shandeen and winning it 4-3. A month earlier, we would have celebrated along with Harry on the front porch. I would have sprinted around the bases in the yard, sliding into second just like Stan the Man. Such a dramatic victory would have sent us all to bed happy, though Pappy would still want to fire the manager. But things were different now. The win meant little. The season was ending with the Cardinals in third place. The front yard had been overwhelmed by the Sproles. Summer was gone. Pappy turned off the radio with Harry winding down.
"There's no way Baumholtz can catch him," Pappy said.
Frankie Baumholtz of the Cubs was 6 points behind Musial in the race for the hitting title. My father grunted his agreement. The men had been quieter than usual during the game. The storms and cool weather had struck them like an illness. The seasons were changing, yet nearly one-third of the cotton was still out there. We'd had near-perfect weather for 7 months. Surely, it was time for a change.